Sharing is caring. That's how the saying goes. But when a popular startup that helps people share rides in their cars tried to set up shop in Kansas City, government officials were less than thrilled. In fact, they issued a letter informing the company, Lyft, of failure to comply with city ordinances. I'm Gina Kaufman. On today's Central Standard, we'll get the story behind that move and we'll learn more about companies like Lyft. What accounts for their growing popularity? Plus, we'll visit the home of a Kansas City man who has turned two bedrooms of his house into crash pads for travelers through Airbnb. That's coming up right after this news. Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. Today we're going to get to know something called the sharing economy. Some see it as an innovative new business model. Others see it as a euphemism that allows tech startups offering rides and lodging to claim exception to regulations that apply to traditional taxi and hotel businesses. Airbnb helps property owners to profit by renting out unused rooms. Lyft helps car owners profit by offering rides. But is this sharing, as the new companies like to say, or is it running a business? Are the homeowners and drivers employees, or are they users of a technology platform? Depends on who you ask. We're going to start this hour by catching up on the Kansas City news that sparked this discussion. A few weeks ago, a company called Lyft moved into Kansas City. At its most basic level, the San Francisco-based startup connects people who need rides with people who have cars. The drivers who register with Lyft put trademark pink mustaches on the front of their cars. Austin Alonzo, a reporter with the Kansas City Business Journal, is here to tell us what happened when the company started seeking out drivers here in Kansas City. Hi, Alonzo.
Hey, good morning. How are you guys doing?
Great. So tell us the story.
Okay. Well, what happened is they came into town, I believe, last Thursday, and apparently they're operating illegally. That's what the city says. They issued them a letter, the city's Regulated Industries Division, which manages, I believe, taxi services and other regulated industries, hence the name, sent them a letter on April 14th saying that they're in violation of several city ordinances, three specific city ordinances, and apparently they didn't get a reply from Lyft. So they're saying the company is operating illegally in Kansas City and that, you know, they're going to be issuing citations until they can bring them inside the law. It's also been, I guess, kind of offensive to the established taxi companies here in Kansas City because they've said, you know, this company doesn't follow the same rules that we have to. They don't have to pay the same fees and do all the same stuff that we have to.
What are those fees? What fees do regular taxis pay?
Well, sure. They pay registration fees. They have to get their driver's license. They have to get special insurance. Bill George is the name of the guy who leads the Kansas City Transportation Group, which is the biggest taxi company in Kansas City. And he said, you know, it's thousands of dollars of fees every year that they pay to the city to be with inside the law and have the privilege of operating a taxi company in Kansas City.
Why do those fees exist? Presumably there's a reason.
Well, I believe it's for safety. You know, the city has said that it's a safety-related thing. That way you know that your driver has been background checked. You know the car operates safely. You know that all the mechanics work. And you know, I guess, you feel safer by knowing that they're fully licensed, that they've gone through the inspections, and that, you know, they are insured. And I think that some of the people who have issues with Lyft say, you know, they aren't insured, they aren't licensed, they aren't inspected. And that's one of the big sticking points, I guess, right now, one of the reasons why the city continues to say that they're operating illegally.
So you're talking about a kind of insurance, for example, and a kind of inspection, for example, that goes beyond what regular car owners, drivers go through when they get a vehicle licensed with the city?
No, I'm not an expert on the licensing process.
Okay.
I mean, I've only written a little bit about it. So I couldn't tell you, you know, everything about the full inspection that they go through. So
okay.
That's not my area of expertise.
All right. Well, what are the ordinances that the city claims Lyft is in violation of?
Well, they sent a letter. It was signed by Jim Reddy, who is the manager of the Regulated Industries Division. You know, and he said that there were ordinances concerning the applicability of Article to third-party third-party transportation apps, soliciting passengers and accepting passengers and assessing fares. The letter said, you know, based on the ordinances above, your company is not able to provide the service as described on your website. And apparently they haven't communicated, the city hasn't communicated much with Lyft at all. The newest development, and I reported on this in our Friday paper, was that apparently there is going to be some kind of meeting coming up between the city of Kansas City and Lyft to bring the ride-sharing company within the city's ordinances and have them operating legally.
And just so our listeners know, we did speak with Chris Hernandez, Deputy Director of City Communications for the Office of the City Manager. He informed us that a meeting is scheduled this week with Lyft, and it will be the first formal meeting between Kansas City officials and Lyft. So we'll be interested to see how that plays out. But in the meantime, Mayor Sly James did send out a series of tweets about the situation with Lyft. Did you read those?
Yeah, I saw those tweets.
How would you categorize his position via Twitter?
Well, you know, I can't look him up right now, and I don't have a crystal clear memory of it. But, you know, I spoke with Ed Ford, who is a councilman on the Kansas City Council for a story I did recently. You know, and he said that people in City Hall weren't exactly pleased that they essentially just rolled into Kansas City and operated illegally and then started to exert pressure via online media and social media on the city. They felt like that was unfair and, I guess, unprofessional to them. That's what he told me, was the attitude around City Hall. And I think if I remember correctly from the tweets, that the mayor said, you know, you have to follow the law regardless of how innovative your business is and how entrepreneurial you are. I mean, the laws are on the books for a reason. And until the laws change, they have to follow them. And I believe that's the city's position on it.
Do you know who gets to decide whether a new business falls within the regulatory parameters of an existing industry, or if it's something so new that it requires its own set of laws and regulations?
Well, I think that's interesting. You know, I got a statement. I haven't communicated much with Lyft. You know, I've called them numerous times and I've sent them numerous emails, and their press people don't reply to the emails. They don't respond to the calls. So I haven't had a great opportunity to speak with them. But they did send me an email one time, and they said that the peer-to-peer ride-sharing model does not fit existing regulations for taxis and limos. We're reaching out to city leaders to look forward to working together. So I believe that what they're trying to do is to modify the law somewhat so they do get inside that. I mean, going back to the original question, I believe it's regulated industries who monitors and decides who's within the law when it comes to this type of transportation service. But it's the Kansas City Council and I guess the state and national legislatures who ultimately make the broader laws governing it. But I think this is mostly a city issue, although there have been a couple consumer alerts issued by six different states, I believe Michigan and Maryland were the two states to most recently issue consumer warnings advising people not to serve as Lyft drivers, not to ride in Lyft cars because they believe there is an issue with the coverage that the drivers have and the risk that both the driver and the passengers are put at because of they're going in the car that doesn't have the same insurance policy that the taxi companies have.
There's been a similar situation in St. Louis, speaking of state legislature. What do you know about that?
I know that our partner publication, the St. Louis Business Journal, has written a lot about it. I believe there was a court order of some sort that stopped them from operating there. And I believe the statement that Lyft said was that they were saddened that they could not operate in St. Louis. So that's as much as I know about that. I'm afraid I'm not an expert on the St. Louis operation.
What do you think is the need that's being filled, both for the drivers who take an interest in operating this kind of a business using their existing cars, and also for people who have the option of using an existing taxi service but are opting for whatever reason to use Lyft? What is the need there?
What is the need? You know, I think that people who drive are looking to get a little bit more money. I mean, I haven't spoken with a Lyft driver here in Kansas City, but I believe that people are looking to make a little more extra money, making trips that otherwise make, you know, sharing a ride and receiving payment for it. I believe that's the benefit they seek. And then, you know, I've seen a couple other stories on this topic. I know Lyft was originated in San Francisco, essentially because it's hard to get a cab in San Francisco, and they wanted to devise an alternative method. And I was recently speaking with a friend about this topic, and he thinks it's interesting, you know, as they continue to expand into other markets where there are monopolies on taxi companies and their limited transportation options, that Lyft fills a need that, you know, public transportation does not serve right now. So I think there's benefit there for the driver to make, you know, a little bit extra money. And then there's benefit for the public to have another option to move around the city with.
You mentioned that the city's position was essentially that this company had rolled into town without talking to anyone or doing anything formal to engage the city in the process. What would be the standard procedure for setting up a business in a new city? What would normally happen?
No, I'm not an expert on business licensing, so I don't know if I can talk too much about that.
All right. Well, the city and Lyft are going to sit down for a meeting this week. If you could be at the table with these two parties, is there anything that you would want to communicate to them or urge them to do or not do?
Well, I'd rather be a fly on the wall, you know, and just kind of see what they talk about. I think that'd be an interesting conversation to be in, just to have an opportunity to talk to Lyft a little bit more and talk to some of the people in the city who are at the heart of the issue. You know, I'd really like to find out what can be done to change existing codes or maybe to modify the existing codes to put Lyft and other ride-sharing companies, because there are other ride-sharing companies out there, to bring them inside the ordinances. I think it would be interesting to ask, you know, what specifically will be changed, you know, if there's going to need to be any kind of council action, if there's going to need to be any kind of legal action, you know, just to find out what steps will be necessary to bring Lyft with inside the law. Because I think, as I mentioned, with these other companies out there, I mean, there's a lot of room for this new sharing economy, I believe is what you called it when you were starting off the show, this new sharing economy to grow in Kansas City, because I think it, you know, we're here talking about it right now. So I think a lot of people are excited about it and a lot of people want to see it do well, or at the very least, you know, continue to stay in Kansas City.
Thanks so much for talking with us, Alonzo. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and I wish you happy reporting as you continue on this story.
All right. Thank you very much.
That's been Austin Alonzo from the Kansas City Business Journal. And now we're going to get some context for how this conversation and others like it are playing out across the nation and indeed beyond. We're going to turn to Arun Sundarajan from the Stern School of Business at NYU. He joins us not from New York, but from Paris. And Arun, what brings you to Paris?
Thanks for having me. I'm at a conference called WeShareFest. This is a conference dedicated to this emerging collaborative peer sharing economy. It's over 1,000 people in a cabaret in Paris. It's some really good business talks, some really good talks from, you know, activists. Sort of all in all, it's been an extremely informative 2 days.
So that really drives home that this is not just a local issue. This is a pretty wide-ranging issue with implications that are global. How would you describe that situation? What's happening to our economy, either prompting this sharing economy or driven by it?
Well, you're absolutely right in saying that this is a global issue, because the same kind of situation that is being described as playing out in Kansas, you're seeing something similar playing out in Paris, you're seeing it playing out in Barcelona and Madrid, you're seeing it playing out in Milan. There are new ways of providing familiar things that are being facilitated by platforms like Lyft. And that's why we have the kind of regulatory conflict that you're seeing. This isn't like Google, a new search engine that is sort of different from anything that we've seen, or Facebook, a social networking site. These are creating sort of new ways of doing things that are very familiar to us.
Well, and also it's in the physical, it has tentacles in the physical world, that we're talking about cars that drive on the streets and, as we'll discuss later, rooms and houses that are in our cities made of bricks on the ground. It's a little different in that sense too.
Absolutely. And I think that the reason why you're seeing this regulatory conversation play out sort of city after city around the world is because of the fact that we're talking about familiar real-world services like short-term accommodation, point-to-point transportation. We've already developed a set of guidelines, a set of rules, a set of screening, a licensing process for providers of this who do it full-time and do it the traditional way. And so when the new models come along, provided by people who aren't professional full-time drivers, but, you know, are sort of blurring the lines between personal and commercial, their new supply model isn't quite fitting into the old regulatory boxes.
Well, why don't you give us some perspective here? Tell us the business professor's perspective of what a sharing economy is, maybe just a working definition to help people understand it.
Well, one part of the sharing economy you can think of as new business models that allow people to get access to goods and services without having to own assets. So getting access to a car without having to own it, getting access to tools without having to own them. Another dimension of it, and you know, it's one of those terms whose scope is still evolving, so there's no one clear definition. But the part of it that is raising the most interest is the creation of a whole new set of peer-to-peer service markets. These are marketplaces like Lyft, like Airbnb, in which individuals can start to offer real-world services to other individuals.
So I was just asking our previous guest, what is the need that's being filled by these things? And I feel like it's something bigger than a need to maybe earn a little extra cash, although that's a pretty big need. But I mean, societally, because this is happening around the world.
Well, I think it's fulfilling a number of needs on both the supply side and the demand side and on the sort of the sociological side. So on the supply side, I think that it's providing people who want to get some employment, but perhaps are not interested in full-time jobs or who are between jobs. I've spoken to a number of Lyft drivers, for example, when I visit San Francisco, and more often than not, they're either between jobs, they are transitioning in their careers, or they are pursuing some sort of, their either DJs or artists or sculptors, and they need some way of earning some money, and this provides them with a way of doing that without actually sort of having to have a full-time job.
Do you think this is in some ways sort of a post-recession phenomenon?
To some extent it is. I think it was catalyzed by the recession, but I don't think that that's all it is. I think there's sort of like a confluence of technological and social factors that have made us ready for the sharing economy. So we've got these people who are fulfilling their dreams, so to speak, or sort of leading the lives that they want to lead by, you know, making money in these flexible ways. I think it also fulfills a market need in that, you know, taxi service in most cities in the United States, except maybe New York and perhaps Las Vegas, is pretty spotty. And once Lyft and Uber gain scale, they offer a sort of a pretty compelling alternative, especially when it's cold. I also think that more broadly, the sharing economy is fulfilling a desire that people have to sort of form connections with other human beings when they're engaging in day-to-day economic transactions. I think technology has sort of made us more isolated than we should be, and technological progress, and we're not happy with the sort of the faceless individual sorts of economic transactions that we're used to. And so, you know, when a new alternative that is peer-to-peer, that involves interacting with another human being in some sort of meaningful way comes along, I think this is a draw for many people.
So sharing a car ride, for example.
Yep, or staying in someone's apartment, perhaps being social about that, just, you know, sort of the non-artificial human touch is something that I think is a part of a need that it is fulfilling, the need to sort of connect with other people.
So you mentioned sharing a room in someone's apartment. You're referring, I think, to Airbnb. Can you tell us a little bit about that for those listeners who may not be familiar with it?
Okay, so Airbnb is a large internet-based marketplace that allows people who have space to rent it out short-term to other people who are looking for short-term accommodation. This could either be a room in your apartment, a room in your house, or it could be the entire property, your entire house, your entire apartment. You set the price. you list it on Airbnb. People who are looking for short-term accommodation in your city will contact you requesting, like, you know, your space. You can screen them and decide whether you want to say yes or no. If you say yes, then they get your apartment or your room. They pay the rate that you have posted. Airbnb completes the transaction, takes a commission.
Well, I visited this weekend the home of someone who rents his home through Airbnb. Bob McCollum regularly rents two rooms in his house in Midtown via a website called Airbnb. He's long been a couch surfer even before that was a thing. So when Airbnb started, Bob was a natural. This weekend, I stopped by his place to see how it works, and one of the rooms he rents used to be his daughter's.
This was her room, and she picked out the aubergine color.
Exactly.
And it has private bath, en suite, as we say on the listing. And she was here just a few, actually a few months before she went out to live with her boyfriend.
You have sort of a spare yet warm aesthetic, and I'm struggling for whether there's a term to describe this architectural style. It's familiar, but I don't know. Is there a term that you would use?
I'd say IKEA.
And there's a world map with pins in it.
And those are where all of my guests have come from, all over the world, from Anchorage to Australia. Most of the people are from the United States or Western Europe. And 2 days ago, there was a man here who was raised in England, but he lived in Lucerne. And he was the licensing managing attorney for the European Soccer Federation. And he was on an extended train trip around the United States. He spent 3 days here.
I love that you look at this map and you see all of these stories. Is that why you have people putting the pins in here?
It is, absolutely. Because you meet the nicest people. And I've had probably 80 people here and have never had anyone that I wouldn't want to have back. When I first started doing this, the people that weren't really into the sharing would say to me, "Aren't you afraid someone will come and steal something from your house?" And I said, "You haven't been in my house, but if you came to my house, what they'd probably do is leave me something." Because I only got a television about 3 weeks ago, and I'm ready to get rid of it. I don't have much.
All right, let's go see the rest of the house.
Okay. And it's surprising, although I have this living room and the dining room available, most of my guests stay in the bedroom on their computers on my free Wi-Fi or Skype and talk to their friends and relatives.
Have you ever had a guest who maybe seemed not as into the concept in practice as he or she had been in theory?
Well, I have a lot of people that this is their first time ever. And usually it's the young people that it's the first time, or they're trying to convince their parents to stay in someone's house. And when I first started doing this, I had some trepidations about staying in someone's house, but that was like 25 or 30 years ago. And that's when I started doing Airbnbs in Europe and in Canada. But when it came here, I thought, this is a great idea. When the weather's really nice, they all eat breakfast out here on the deck or dinner. And I just actually, since my back door is my front door for all of my guests, I decided to fix this up with potted plants and so forth and a garden. And they sit out here in the sun and read the paper.
Are there zoning laws that you have to think about? Like, are there neighborhoods where this is illegal?
I think it is if you live in an apartment or you live in maybe a condominium with, covenants and restrictions. But in Kansas City, Missouri, five unrelated people can stay in the same home. And since we don't cook and provide meals, it's not really technically a bed and breakfast. And I've looked at the zoning regulations, and a bed and breakfast, traditionally where you serve meals, has got to be a certain number of square footage and not over so many units. This is just like having relatives come in that help you pay your bills.
That was Bob McCollum walking me through his residence near 39th Street in Kansas City. And we're going to talk now with Taylor Nelms, who's here on the line from the University of California, Irvine. Taylor is an anthropologist. And Taylor, what is an anthropologist's interest in this phenomenon of a sharing economy?
Hi, Gina. Thanks for having me. I think that there's a whole series of sociocultural shifts that are being associated with the rise of this sharing economy, and in many ways, the so-called sharing economy is sort of introducing a whole set of debates that have surrounded the introduction of new technologies for a long time.
Well, for example, we've heard about some of the sociological shifts, like people feeling maybe isolated by technology and treasuring these opportunities to share a car ride or instead of a hotel stay to enjoy staying in someone's home. Is there anything else? I was thinking that maybe environmentalism could play a role, like that someone would maybe feel some satisfaction from not buying a car.
Right. I mean, on the one hand, I think the most importantly for many people, the idea of the sharing economy opens up a debate about what should orient economic activity generally, like what kind of values should be embedded in our economy. So for some, the sharing economy reintroduces the social, right, as a way of organizing and orienting the economy, as your previous guest Arun nicely put it, right, the non-artificial human touch. And here there are lots of overlaps with efforts around the world to create alternative currencies, to foster solidarity economies in Latin America, Europe, and elsewhere. But as you put it, there are other important debates that are being opened up about, for instance, growth, right? And I think we're seeing a trend across many spaces towards finding ways to reduce waste, making use of what we already have of existing assets, right? And this relates right to what Arun said about the importance of shift from privileging the individual private ownership of things to access without the ownership of assets.
It seems like this is, a while ago, I would have been hard-pressed to imagine that there would be almost a movement taking place where people would rather get in someone else's car, a stranger, than get in their own car. And this idea of private space being turned public and commercial, is that a bigger shift than just an economic shift?
Well, I think that, if economic anthropology has a lesson for us about public and private space, we know that this division is not fixed or given in advance. And so what counts as public space or private domain can change over time. And so, for instance, the rise of large indoor and outdoor shopping centers or malls, right, is a good example. We often treat malls as public space. We act as if they are public space, and we often think of ourselves as being in public when we're there. But, of course, they're legally and economically private in all sorts of ways. And I think the Internet represents a similar, perhaps even more profound challenge to our notions of what's public and what's private.
Right. And of course, the Internet is located, out there in the ether. But when these businesses start operating in specific physical locations, like a city, a state, then the interaction between this sort of broad non-physical entity and the local laws and the local streets, that becomes profound, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I think it's interesting, right, that you mentioned sort of commercial, the public domain here being a commercial domain, right? I think that for some, right, sharing represents a kind of alternative to what they see as a larger capitalist system because it re-embeds social relations in exchange. But for others, and I think this is a really key point of contention, it's eminently capitalist, right? So while often deploying the language of sociality and community, many sharing economy startups are also linked to what we would otherwise see as a kind of unfettered marketness, right? Whether that's demand pricing or surge pricing by ride-sharing companies like Uber or Lyft, or in the attempt to make government regulation of all kinds obsolete by creating self-policing online transaction platforms, right, that supposedly run on trust and reputation.
Right. This word sharing is pretty fascinating because in normal sharing, like when you're talking to a preschooler and you say, we share our toys, you don't mean by that, you borrow my blocks and I take some money from you. That's
right. What is the sharing economy if you're paying for it, right? And so in this case, I'm not entirely sure how new the sharing economy is. In many ways, these are economic practices that have existed for a long time. The sharing economy consists perhaps of new technological platforms and mobile applications that enable the scaling of those practices that people have always done. But ride sharing, sharing of all kinds, short-term lending, gifting labor, collaborative consumption, everyday micro exchanges based on trust or reputation or status, these are already part of our repertoires of economic practice. And so what we're doing is building new tools, right, to facilitate and keep track of them.
Well, I want to bring back Arun Sundararajan, who's with us from the Stern School of Business at NYU, but joining us from a conference in Paris. And Arun, have you been listening to this conversation about this terminology and the larger phenomenon?
Yes, I have, and I participated in a similar conversation earlier today at the conference about the misuse of the term sharing and how I think that even within the set of people who consider themselves part of the sharing economy, the idea that certain sort of commercial activities are labeled as sharing is troubling and perhaps sort of like, you know, distracting from what's really happening.
So what would you say
is
really
happening?
Yeah.
Well, we are, at its root, any sort of economic transaction is going to be familiar. It involves people sort of exchanging goods and services with other people for money, perhaps sort of like as barter and with some underlying trust mechanism. So I agree with your previous guest that, you know, sort of with that broader definition, I guess it's not new. It's just sort of scaling particular behaviors. But I think the fact that it's scaling them is at the heart of, like, you know, the conflict between Lyft and Kansas City. And
right. What's interesting to me, if I can,
it's because we're sort of blurring these lines between what used to be personal and what used to be professional. So, you know, if I went to the airport and picked up a friend or I picked up a group of visitors and I gave them a ride to their hotel, the city wouldn't mind. If I lent my apartment to someone periodically, there wouldn't be any additional screening that I'd need to go to. If I lent some money to start a business and they were a friend of mine, I wouldn't have to be, you know, sort of certified as a professional investor. And it's the scaling of these things, the fact that I'm not doing it occasionally, I'm doing it for 5 hours a week, or I'm doing it, you know, into 10 companies, or I'm lending out a room, you know, 15 times a year. It's the scaling of these that is what is bringing them into the regulatory focus, because we've now got this class of service providers that, you know, clearly it doesn't make sense to regulate them exactly the way you would regulate a taxi driver or a hotel. But we need some sort of infrastructure. And as a society, we have to decide, like, you know, what is the trade-off we're going to be making here? I mean, like, you know, I don't think that anybody wants sort of unfettered sort of market-based systems. And I think that what we're trying to do is create a new regulatory infrastructure
Arun,
is inclusive of these blurring lines between personal and commercial.
I want to back up here a little bit because many of our listeners might not know what some of the very specific legal battles have been going on with both Lyft and Airbnb and also a similar ride-sharing service called Uber. Could you summarize just a couple of those cases? There are many of them.
Yes, there are. I mean, the salient ones are both Lyft and Uber, which are sort of point-to-point transportation taxi-like services, have faced numerous challenges from different cities around the world who say that they look like taxis, but they aren't licensed to be taxis. Uber has had challenges in New York, in Washington, D.C., in Paris, in Madrid, in Barcelona, in even in San Francisco, until they came up with a new regulatory infrastructure. Similarly, Airbnb's perhaps most significant legal challenge is a conflict that they've been having with the New York State Attorney General over the provision of full-time hotel services. It's alleged that a lot of people are running illegal hotels on the Airbnb platform. And, at the heart of that conflict is the same problem, that there are some people who are blurring the lines between personal and commercial, and we don't really know how to categorize them. And until we give this sort of informal economy, some form of formalization, we're not going to be able to sort of prevent people who are actually trying to skirt the law and stop them. So these are two of the salient cases here.
How are people trying to skirt the law? Can you explain that?
Well, let's say that there are certain regulations that you need to adhere to if you're running a 20-room hotel. Without getting into the details of whether those are good regulations or not, tend to be the law. So it's reasonable to do well, you know, law, then if you're running a 20-person hotel, you have to adhere to that law. On the other hand, if you're renting out your apartment 10 times a year, maybe the overhead associated with registering to your hotel and jumping through all the necessary may not be the best use of society's resources. But if we don't have a way of regulating
or categorizing the people who provide personal service, or like, you know, who do it occasionally, then someone rent 20 apartments around New York City or around Kansas City.
Okay, Arun, we've got the music, so we're going to have to get back to this in just a second, but we are going to continue this conversation about businesses that operate according to a sharing economy when we come back from the break.
Okay.
And we'd like to hear from our listeners, too, at 816-235-2888, especially if you have used one of these services or if you operate a business through one. We'll be back just in a few. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we are talking today with Arun Sundarajan and Taylor Nelms about a sharing economy, businesses like Airbnb, Lyft, Uber, and a whole host of others who are operating on the premise that your personal property could be turned into a source of income through some complex maneuvering. And it is, to some, very simple, and to others, very complex. And we'd just love to hear from you if you have used any of the businesses that fall under the umbrella of a sharing economy. Do you make extra money by offering your services through one? Call us and talk to us about it. 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Taylor Nelms, you've been listening to Arun Sundarajan talk about some of the conflicts that are erupting in various cities. You know, we have, on the one hand, there are employees, or there are people who are drivers for Lyft suing Lyft over the idea that they are employees and not contractors. There are cities being sued by their own taxi and limo services for allowing services like Lyft to exist in them. What do you think is going on here? Are we working through a major cultural shift right now?
I'm not sure how major the cultural shift is that we're working through, but I do think that some of the conflicts that we're seeing arise over the use of the sharing economy, the kinds of people who work for the sharing economy, are really interesting for thinking about the economy more generally. You mentioned earlier, you asked Arun to what degree the sharing economy is a post-recession economy, and I think that that's a question that we have to think about. To what degree is the rise of these kinds of sharing economy activities on both the consumption and supply sides more about a response to labor insecurity? I think it's no coincidence, right, that it happened in the aftermath of the financial crisis. Are we simply glossing over a certain kind of labor precarity by rebranding work as sharing? These platforms and mobile applications are interesting in that they face multiple directions. So they have to attend to their suppliers, the kinds of people who will drive their own cars around, and as well as their consumers. And on the consumer protection side, I think that there's a whole host of questions that are being worked out now and have yet to really be resolved. And I think it's interesting, right, that regulations governing consumer protections at this level are often written and enforced by municipalities. So in many ways, regulations that have been around for decades about health inspections, right, of shared accommodations, of hotels and other lodgings that have been around for a long time are all of a sudden becoming newly important as a result of the sharing economy. And so for me, at least, the sharing economy is a really interesting case to think about the ways that our economy is sort of always multiple, right? That we don't do only one kind of economic activity, that we can have multiple motivations at once. And so the kinds of technologies that constitute the sharing economy are in many ways making visible that multiplicity.
Arun, are there some cities that are more hospitable than others to these sharing economy business models? Well, we'll get back to Arun. Oh, excuse me. Arun, could you answer that question? Are there some cities that are more hospitable than others to these sharing economy business models?
Well, I think San Francisco and California in general seem to have made the greatest effort to change the regulatory infrastructure to be accommodating. I think that New York City, on the other hand, ironically, because New York City could perhaps benefit most from the new sharing economy.
Benefit how?
I think companies, because New York City is a sharing economy already. It's an old style sharing economy. We already share transportation, we share space, we eat sort of like, you know, our food is prepared by other people rather than cooked at home, takeout restaurants. And so you know, densely populated urban areas like New York, people are used to the consumption of shared services and the use of shared assets. But it's precisely because it's so integral to the lives of the people that the regulations are so well formed. It's like we've come up with rules and good rules for doing things the old way. And so the barriers to sort of letting in new business models are in some way the highest in such cities. And so New York City is perhaps sort of like, you know, less hospitable to the sharing economy than
Is there a way for cities to work with these businesses? I mean, I've read about the possibility of cities maybe establishing their own hosting platforms as an alternative as well.
Well, I think the most effective way is sort of recognize, try and recognize the value that's being created for their local economies by these sharing economy activities, and try to sort of create a new sort of set of regulations that are inclusive of this blurring between sort of like, you know, personal and commercial. I mean, I think that there, you know, if your city economy can support people who are working part-time in these different ways and providing services that bring people into your city, and we don't really have a good sense for how large this is, this sort of invisible work, like, you know, the work that isn't really jobs. But it's certainly substantial in many cities. And, you know, some of my research, in fact, I only bring this up because it's funded in part by the Ewing Marion Kauffman Foundation, which is based in Kansas City.
Oh, interesting.
They are sort of supporters of measuring the sharing economy better. But, you know, we know that it's there. We know that it's contributing in important ways. The existence of this invisible work, of this part-time work through sharing and other platforms like Etsy, which is a marketplace for people who make stuff. And we think that it's big, and we think that it has an important impact. And so I think there's a good incentive for cities to work with the sharing platforms to come up with a good division of who's responsible for what to make sure that the new forms of providing these familiar services are safe and are easily providable.
It sounds like if this work is invisible, work that isn't jobs as you describe it, and you're not sure how big it is that an indication that taxes aren't being paid? I mean, it seems like that's a way that cities could benefit from this.
That's certainly one way. They could certainly benefit. You know, if it generates income, like, you know, and your city has a city income tax, then it probably is generating tax. If it involves commerce and sales tax is paid, like, you know, if someone is selling a service and they put tax on it. And so I think that a non-trivial fraction of the taxes that could be collected are being collected. But certainly, like, you know, stimulating the local economy, giving people who live in your city sort of a wider variety of ways in which they can live their lives, but it doesn't always have to be a full-time job. You know, I've been told that 20% of the U.S. workforce now considers themselves freelance or not having a single, one full-time job, and that number is going to grow substantially in the next decade. So I think the cities that are supportive of the platforms that facilitate this kind of independent freelance work in new ways are going to be cities that become desirable. People will want to get a wide variety of services. So, you know, taxes are certainly one benefit, but I see more fundamental economic benefits that go well beyond that.
All right. Well, we've got some callers here, and I'll get to them in a second. But I do want to say, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming live at kcur.org. I'm Gina Kaufman, and I'm talking today about a sharing economy, businesses like Lyft, Airbnb, and Uber. And we're talking about that in light of recent news that Lyft in Kansas City, Missouri, are in a conversation about how they might iron out some of their regulatory differences so that business might be able to operate here in Kansas City. We'll take calls from you now about the sharing economy. 816-235-2888. We've got Meg in Kansas City, Missouri on the line. Hi, Meg.
Hi there. I just wanted to call and say that I actually just moved to Kansas City from Chicago, where I didn't have a car, and I used Lyft and Uber almost exclusively. And I think one of the things that hasn't been brought up in the conversation is the difference between those things and cab companies. You know, when you call a cab, you may not know when it's going to show up. You don't know who's driving it. And with those services, you call up the cab on your phone, and then you can actually watch it on a map on your phone coming to you. You know exactly when it's going to be there. You know who's going to be driving the car. So I think there's this sort of, like, dependability about Uber and Lyft and services like that that make them different than cab companies. And arguably, I think it makes them better. So I think, you know, there need to be regulations and laws that make sure that those companies are compliant. But in a way, I do think we need to adjust those to make room for some of these more innovative and better technologies, because they're, I think they're so much more dependable, which is why people love them.
Well, Arun, is this standard competition or is it something else? It sounds like the argument there was, that these businesses can compete for a reason.
Yes, that's a really good point, because I think that this underscores the fact that, you know, this isn't just a recession era phenomenon. It isn't sort of the low cost alternative. A lot of people see these new services, whether they are apartments on Airbnb or rides through Lyft and Uber, as being superior in quality, sort of higher quality, more convenient, greater level of consumer empowerment. I've seen people watch the little car come, and, you know, it sort of gets to the point where people are frustrated. They're like, damn, he's turning right, and you're like, you know, he should have been turning left. And, you know, there's this sort of incredible granularity that you can actually see exactly where your taxi is. And so, you know, the increase in variety and the increase in quality is an important part of the story.
And what is different qualitatively about the experience? Why is riding in a car that's run by an Uber driver somehow different? And to what extent do these companies regulate themselves?
Well, it's different in that you feel a much greater sense of control over the experience because, like, you know, as the listener pointed out, you have a picture of who's going to be driving you and you know exactly when they're going to be arriving. You know what car they're going to be driving. and I think that it's, you know, some of the regulation is done by the platforms. I think before there was any move by the city, I mean, you know, these are profit-making marketplaces. And so if the product is considered safe and reliable and high quality by the riders, nobody's going to use it. If someone turns up in, like, a lousy car and is impolite and, you know, sort of doesn't seem like they know how to drive and, you know, doesn't seem like under the influence of drugs or alcohol, then clearly the marketplace is going to fail. So there's a natural incentive up to a point for the platforms themselves to regulate. The model that I like here is California's, and only because they've come up with sort of a split between the government and the platforms. What they've done is they've said, hey, this is a new form of providing transport. It shouldn't be regulated the way we used to regulate taxis. But on the other hand, we don't just want to sort of hand over the reins to the platforms. So let's come up with a set of guidelines that we want, a set of rules that we want all of the drivers to follow. Let's give them to registered platforms, but let's delegate the responsibility of enforcing these rules, whether it's a zero drug and alcohol tolerance policy, vehicle inspections, particular kinds of, like, you know, screening. Let's delegate that job to the platforms.
And let's go ahead and talk now to Todd in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Todd.
Hello, good morning.
What can you share with us?
Well, really just kind of add on to what has already been said, in that we have a room that we make available to students who stay with us. Most of them are international students, and I have two kids, and so it's a great opportunity to introduce them to people from other foreign countries. And so they get to know them, and it's also a good way for the students to learn English because they're able to communicate with the children much better. And secondly, having traveled extensively, it's also a great opportunity for me to kind of live vicariously, if you will, through their experience of coming to a foreign country and just being in a, you know, foreign environment, and just the sensation that you have when you're in a new land. And to be with somebody who's local to show you around to some of the places, that makes a more enriching experience. And then, you know, I have to say, I do also do this for as a side income, because, you know, they do pay to stay in the house, but, you know, we also at the end of the year have to file that for our taxes. And so it is a side business that we use, but it's also a very cultural enriching experience as well.
With this sort of gray area about business versus personal enterprise, I do wonder who is responsible if something happens, like while someone's staying at your Airbnb residence. Are you responsible, or is Airbnb?
Well, we're not an Airbnb, but we're just a host to students. So they have their own insurance when they're here. But at the same time, you know, we do look out for their welfare and make sure that they're well taken care of.
Well, thanks so much, Todd. I'm glad you're having such an enriching experience.
You bet.
And now let's talk to Alan in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Alan.
Hi. We've stayed in Airbnb in Italy, Germany. My daughter is in France right now. We stayed in some amazing places. We showed up at people's houses with an operational gate that opened up, a two-car garage for us to park in, fresh bakery foods for us for breakfast in the morning.
It sounds really, really nice, Ellen. I'm sorry, but we have run out of time for today's conversation. I want to thank our callers and also Taylor Nelms, a PhD candidate in anthropology at the University of California, Irvine. Taylor's a research assistant at the Institute for Money, Technology, and Financial Inclusion. I'd also like to thank Arun Sundarajan of the Stern School of Business at the New York University, joining us by Skype from a conference in Paris. I hope he enjoys his evening in Paris now that he can get back to that. To listen back to today's show, go to kcur.org/centralstandard. Stay current on Central Standard News by following us on Twitter. Our handle is @KCURCST. Tune in tomorrow as we explore banned children's books and the importance of diversity among educators. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's it for today. Stay tuned for Up to Date next.